Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean, I can feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And let's talk about enlightenment. I mean, that's the whole point, right? That's the deal. That's the light at the end of the tunnel, the cheese in the mousetrap. This is a talk that was recorded a month ago at our weekly Dharma gathering by Joe Mauricio. Joe Mauricio is a regular contributor to the podcast. He is a performer, writer, life coach, senior teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. And this was a talk he gave, very interesting talk, about, well, it's called A Beginner's Guide to Enlightenment, and it's just that. So let's do it. Let's dive in. Visit our website at ny.shambhala.org for information about classes and weekend retreats. In particular, I recommend Meditation in Everyday Life, our introductory meditation course, which is beginning on April 6th. It's a great introduction opportunity to ask questions. You'll be loaded with lots of confidence to start your own home personal meditation practice. So visit ny.shambhala.org, click classes and programs for that or any other upcoming program. And now, Joe Mauricio, take it away.
I have a to-do list like everyone else. My list is, though, very specifically things I'll never do. I just feel like I should write them down and then stare at them every morning. And I think it's really interesting, the discrepancy between the part of our mind that wants to be a good boy or girl, or in between, a good anything, just be good, you know? And the part of our experience that's deeper than that, doesn't know about that so much, just wants to be acknowledged, wants to be accepted or held or known or seen. Interesting. We kind of put ourselves into this square hole. Wait. Can you have a square hole? Well, that's exactly it. Like trying to create things that don't exist that we could never fit into anyway. And to kind of prove something to someone, I don't know who, our father, our older siblings, the government, who is it that's standing over us like a great shadow looking down going, you haven't quite done it yet. You better tense up and push a little harder. Excuse me. I'm going to check my text just for a second. No, I'm kidding. I'm recording this for Phil, who's going to put it on our podcast. So thank you so much. And then, of course, you know all of these talks are on the Shambhala podcast anyway. So you'll get that beginning part that I seem to have forgotten. Tonight's talk is called A Beginner's Guide to Enlightenment. The subtitle is Enlightenment for Dummies. Enlightenment is one of those things that a lot of traditions don't like to talk about. It's kind of like a white non-elephant in the room. It's sort of an idea that people have, but they think it's a little pretentious to discuss it. Nobody quite knows what it is. But two real kind of like axioms, I think, two truisms are that people that have an experience of it really don't talk about it. And people who talk about it really have no idea. That makes me very qualified to give this talk. So I really have no idea whatsoever. And it has occurred to me that that's not a bad position to be in. It's taken me a few years to get there. But at some point when I go, wow, I really don't know what any of this is about. And that's kind of an opening to a freshness of experience, if you see what I mean. Like knowing what things are is helpful sometimes. so you know something, but very quickly you don't pay attention anymore anyway and just do it by rote, right? But when we discover things for the first time, I think there's a sense of real aliveness there. There was a period of time when you discovered your feet for the first time. You just looked at them and giggled. When we smelled things and tasted things and touched things for the first time. This aliveness, this good morning quality. So very much at the beginning of the year is a good time to think about that, the freshness of the early morning, the crispness of a kind of new perspective or new idea, as opposed to the stultifying and safe sameness of knowing the same things and learning the same things again and again, getting better and better, but less and less. At one point, there was a theory in science, this is a couple of decades back, which is light years for science, of course, but the book Chaos came out by James Gleick, and the idea was all of a sudden that some scientists were waking up, the younger generation at that time, to this idea that science was just iterating and reiterating and reiterating a lot of ideas, these premises that they had to then prove, and other people tried to disprove, and there's also funding tied into all of it, and ideas and ego, of course, with anything. Very few people were turning their telescopes onto the dark matter, onto what they don't know. Like all the things out in the universe that we have no idea. We just keep looking at the moon. Oh yeah, it is round. I've verified that. And in some ways, that's kind of what we do in our lives. We look at a small subset of the possibility of our experience and look at it again and again and make sure it's still there. You know? Oh yeah, I'm still always late. Oh yeah. And I'm still working on it. And I'm still doing these things. And maybe we'll get better at that. Maybe slowly, incrementally, we'll get better at doing our to-do list, at showing up on time for jobs we don't really want, for actually making those people proud of us that we don't care about, that actually, you know, kind of creating a life for ourselves that we think is supposed to be a good life. And we might do that. That might be something we succeed at. At some point, it's all going to be pulled out from under us, isn't it? It's all going to be like, oh, well, you succeeded. Now you're dead. See ya. Who came up with that plan? Get born, be born into this amazing and beautiful and provocative world, figure it out just to be snuffed out, like, and then it's over. Like, I signed up for that, I guess. So did you. I like to think that human beings are so brief. Our time is so brief on this planet. Certainly in the timeline of the planet itself, right? 4 billion years old, or the universe they claim is, you know, 4 trillion or 14 trillion. But I think it looks older than it is. I think it's just been, it's getting bigger. So it's definitely getting bigger. But by that timeline, our lifetime is like this. It's so brief. It's like we're mayflies that wake up and go, oh, I'm fat, and then die. You know, we have this brief moment of experiencing things, and we can only see ourselves and what we have to worry about. Then it's kind of over. I wonder how many people on their deathbed go, I nailed it. I did. I nailed it. I do think that there are people on their deathbed, and I've experienced, been fortunate enough, teachers, people who have attained a sense of realization, whatever you'd call it, that actually pass into whatever comes after without any idea of what that may be, or maybe they do have an idea of what that may be. But looking at it like a fresh adventure and actually being quite awake into the experience. Isn't that amazing? The opposite, though, of saying, yeah, I nailed it, or worrying about how much they have in their bank account to take, not take with them, right? There seems to be a sense that if we completely and fully and richly live our lives, that when those lives come to a reasonable ending, we may be willing to let that go. And maybe look at what comes later with some sort of great excitement. But looking at things with excitement has to start here, right now. You know? Like with me, start to think this is going to be a good talk and look at it, listen to it as though you're really interested. Because anything can happen here. Well, some of you are just going, no, I've seen you before, it's going to be the same thing. A few jokes and you're going to tell me to be nice to myself. But I actually desperately want to start to look at the things I don't know about me, you know? To have this idea of being a teacher, it's almost like this idea that I know something. So here I am, imparting this idea to you of what I know. So I started right with the truth. I don't know how to even follow a to-do list. And I'm a coach. I'm a motivational speaker, right? But I try to get people off that thing, you know? I try to get people away from that idea that they have lists of things they have to do before they could live, before they could just be, before they could wake up, you know? A whole list of things. How many people have spent more time single at different times in their lives than they need to because they had a whole list of things the other person had to, you know, a whole bunch of hoops that other person had to jump through, you know? Dating sites, right? It's a list. Well, you should like the outdoors and be educated and good looking. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. Anything but something new. Something that I just meet. Something that is different. And how many times have you actually fallen in love and it wasn't anything like that? It wasn't at all like what you thought it would be. All of a sudden, you wake up and find yourself in a situation that's completely different than what you thought. How many people moved to New York from somewhere else? Remember that first year? I mean, maybe some of you had it easy, but how many had a just harrowing experience in the first little time of moving here, you know? But don't you remember that with certain brightness? Isn't there something really like crisp and bright about that time in our life? It's really interesting. It's like when things are frightening, but not too frightening, just frightening enough that we actually perk up and pay attention, we really, I think, assimilate that information. It really gets deeper into us. I think there are many of us that would remember the heartbreak of a romance, probably as much as any other part of it, if it was significant heartbreak, you know? Some people kind of miss the pain more than the other person, in a way. We get addicted to it because we're feeling, you know? Until it's happening again and again, and then we're just impaling ourselves on the relationship to hurt ourselves and because we don't know what else to do, right? Because we're afraid of open space. That seems to be the idea. We're afraid to look out onto our life and go, oh, it really could be anything. It could be anything. That's a scary thought, isn't it? And I think to kind of assuage ourselves of that, I think it's reasonable to give ourselves a guiding star, so to speak, a pole star, a navigational tool, so that the possibilities of life can make sense to us. If there's something in your life that motivates you or inspires you, you know, then maybe that makes everything else clear and we could start to open up and see, oh, this is going to lead me toward that. This is going to discourage that. This is going to just distract me. Does that make sense, kind of? But I think a lot of people don't have that. Don't think I'm blaming you for that. It's just that our culture doesn't supply that anymore. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands of how many people are inspired by our political leaders and wake up and think, yes, this is a brilliant place to be, you know? Or how many people really feel that anymore about some religion or some part of their life, you know? And it's interesting because we're the richest culture, we're the best educated, or close, or something up there, and we're the least happy in many ways and not clear about what we want. And I think, and I'm talking about America, easily led because nobody really knows what it is we want, you know? Are we on the left? Are we on the right? Are we swinging back and forth, you know? Are we playing one against the other? Do we not care about politics? But where is the guiding star in our life? What is the point and the purpose of our life, you know? One of the principles in the Shambhala tradition is to begin to take these things, these tools or methods that have become stultifying and even aggressive and sort of brain deadening, like an inspirational vision, like patriotism, like any of those things, and see if we can't turn it into something that wakes us up. Like an image of somebody who's completely compassionate and wise. In the Buddhist tradition, from which Shambhala stems, the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, we have the image of a bodhisattva. You've heard the term, enlightened body, it means, or enlightened being. But what it refers to are people that have taken vows to put the benefit of the world ahead of their own enlightenment, ahead of their own spiritual path even, to actually help the world through their own spiritual awareness, right? By not getting lost in the world, but staying with the world. So there have been different schools in spiritual thought. I think whether they're Buddhist or Christian, Muslim, I'm sure, there are different schools whereby people, actually some people, sequester themselves from the world and say, well, the world is bad or it's wrong, and let me go to the spirit. There are lots of people in the New Age communities who do that. And God bless them. That's fine. That's wonderful. You know, they want to be in a higher vibration. I'm guaranteed to lower your vibration. Invite me over to your house. Two drinks and it's going to be... No, kidding. But I think, you know, there is a sense of let's be real. And there is a sense that we could run away from all the pain and suffering in the world through some spiritual grandeur. But is that enlightenment? Is that the end game? To be out of this and leave everyone else here to burn? Could be. And I think the people that sequester themselves from the world and attain some really self-realization probably should be lauded. There's probably something good about that. There's something they're adding to the universe, some level of mental or psychological ability that they're developing. But what about the people willing to roll up their sleeves and really be in it and still work to try to gain more and more clarity, more and more wisdom, and more compassion in their lives? Willing to be in a world where we're not sure what's going to happen. Where no matter what we say or what we believe, nobody knows if this is all going to end up beautifully or if it's going to be a great mess. Or if at some point the asteroid comes and the ant people take over. It's interesting, isn't it? Because the truth of life is we don't know. So because we don't know, there is a tendency for us to hold on to things that we think we should know, right? Like, this is my country. These are my people. And the more we establish the truth of that, the more we come to see other things as the opposite of that, and hence evil. And we bifurcate and split things into the light and the dark. It's really interesting. And what is your light and what is your dark? And are you qualified to decide that for everybody? You know, it's funny, isn't it? My idea of a good time would be my grandmother's idea of hell, right? If she walked into a nightclub with me, it would be, you know, or something like that, right? We're all different, and our psychologies are different, and our experiences are different. How can we just assume, blanketly, that there's one place to go? And yet we need a guiding light, I think, to have clarity or direction in our life. Some sense of maybe making a commitment to wake up, or making a commitment to increase compassion, or making a commitment to become fully and completely enlightened with the world together here. Parceling out all the other possibilities, just talking about the Buddhist tradition, which I know a little more about, the Buddhist tradition breaks down into different categories, and the fundamental Buddhist tradition does, I think, practice a certain sequestering from the world and has an onus on discipline and the idea of personal liberation, sotsotarpa. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. In the Mahayana tradition, they have a story about a meeting that the Buddha had at Vulture Peak Mountain in Rajagriha, where he, through speaking through Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara, which is, you know, one of those philosophical devices, two people, the rational and the compassionate, have a discussion back and forth. And one asks, what is the meaning of unsurpassable enlightenment? And Avalokiteshvara, who is the bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara answers, great, great compassion, unsurpassable compassion, compassion that isn't attached to a body or a religion or a point of view, but still cares. Does that make sense? And they say, this is a kind of an aside little joke, I doubt if there's much historical veracity to it, but the saying is that all the adepts from the earlier traditions had heart attacks. They all were like, what? Nah. Like, everything we studied for is... And it's true at this point. Apparently the Buddha threw it all out the window, which I guess he was wont to do, and said, no, the point isn't enlightenment for you. It's understanding that. And there is this feeling that, they say, that unsurpassable complete enlightenment is when we stay in the world and are here to attain any kind of advancement, if you will, for those around us, for those right here, which I guess counters the idea of it being an advancement, and basically starts to talk about here and now, literally here and now, not some cave, not shadows on a cave, not suppositions about here and now, but right here. This cup, your moment, your life, simply as it is, at any point, what keeps us from just realizing this is it? That person that annoys us actually can help us wake up. Those feelings of heartbreak inside actually remind us we're human, that anything can actually bring us into the truth of our experience here. And that we don't have to know what it means. And it doesn't have to make sense. But all we have to do is begin to train our minds to become present, to just be here now. right? Like the saying is, here, now, right? Not thinking about here now. So one of the things the Buddha said at Vulture Peak Mountain was there is no path, no wisdom, no attainment, and no non-attainment. No eye, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no appearance, no sound, no taste, no touch, no dharma. Just this. It's really, really that simple and that brilliant, you know? One of the things maybe we'll think of on a deathbed or in some aware space beyond this life, if there is one, is how much we missed that was right in front of us, you know? I had an amazing experience earlier today, and I said with Jeff, and I had to use this. We were moving a large chair that was here to, because they had a New Year's ceremony. So there was a large chair with a brocade for our teacher to sit, although he's not here, but a commemorative seat for him. And we were moving it out, and we were going through that door, the little door, and trying to angle the chair through the door. It was amazing, right? Literally, two intelligent, college-educated people trying to angle it through the door and then realize that there are these double doors right here, probably, what, 12 feet? Yeah. And I thought, what a metaphor for what we're talking about tonight is that we are spending a lot of time trying to figure out the problem and missing the truth, right? And I wish I could tell you what the truth was. Then, you know, this would be some weird cult. We'd all follow this one belief. But it's not. In particular, this is an open house, so talking about Shambhala is not a cult, for one thing. It's not organized enough. For another thing, the onus is on our individual liberation, right? But for the benefit of all in a community and a society, right? So your enlightenment won't be the same as mine, you know? And your enlightenment won't be the same as yours. We'll all be Buddhas of a different color and a different type and a different kind. So there is actually a great story in the tradition, in the Kagyu tradition, of one of the greatest minds, scholars, at the height probably of Indian spiritual power. And his name was Naropa. And Naropa was teaching at Nalanda University. He was probably the chancellor of it or something, whatever their thing is. And anyway, the dean, but beyond that, he was the greatest mind and had this brilliant mind and was lauded in so many ways and just had accolades and stuff like that. And he walked out one day and came across an older person on the road. That's a classic sort of Buddhist device. Usually people are heading to do something important to attain enlightenment, and the Buddha is actually this older woman saying, hey, wait, and exposing the fact that they're going somewhere and not paying attention to what's here, right? The older woman invariably becomes a deity or the Buddha and says, you missed it again. And this older woman came to Naropa, but Naropa didn't miss it. She confronted him directly, and he said, well, I'm Naropa, therefore I'm blah, 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 or something, because she confronted him and asked for his credentials. And she said, ah, man of learning, but do you understand the words, or do you understand the meaning? Which is to say that all the knowledge in the world doesn't replace the truth of what actually happens. You know, I just spoke to a friend of mine whose father passed away. And I said, how is that? And he's a senior teacher, quite a brilliant teacher here. And he said, you know, we study this, but it's not the same as when it happens. Right? So study can bring you right up against the truth. but it's not the truth. The truth is what we don't know. It's taking that leap into space that we have no idea of and being willing to touch it. And then lose it. And then go back into our head and do our to-do list again, right? But if we can increase these moments of really touching our world, of really seeing the world touch us, the most profound things happening to any of us right now, the most brilliant things, the most poetic and wonderful things are happening right outside. Our birds building nests, or, you know, people walking down the street believing their world and having all of this, like, incredible goodness about them that they can't see, you know? The very natural things about life. The fact that despite all our efforts, there are still trees. There is still grass. There is still beauty and goodness in the world. Despite all of the other stuff. And of course, we could try to fix it, and we will eventually fix it, I'm sure. But occasionally we need to lift our head and maybe be able to see the beauty of what's out there. This might be a good time to have a discussion. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, because I kind of flubbed on it in the talk, is I brought in the idea of a pole star, a guiding voice, but the premise is we don't need to know anything, right? And I can resolve those, and we could talk about it for a while, but I wonder if anybody has an idea about that. Like, how do you find a direction in life that isn't the old, worn pattern we've always taken? Or isn't going to something theoretical, like how great our football team is, or whatever it is, right? Something that really is real. How do we turn our minds to that and still stay open? And still stay open to what's here right now? Any ideas? Yes.
For me, it was cultivating self-awareness through psychotherapy and then becoming a therapist myself.
Mm-hmm.
And using my own experience and suffering to help others.
Wonderful. So your personal path was kind of energized by the people you were helping. So you're healing and helping simultaneously?
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Yeah.
As opposed to becoming, like, a great therapist and...
What is that?
And just seeing your clients, you know, like, sitting in your chair and...
No, it's a process of continuing, in, like, self-awareness on my part, healing on my part, and then transferring that to other people.
Thank you. A wonderful example of a path that's actually open. And I imagine some sessions don't go exactly as planned, right?
They never do.
Wonderful. Does anybody else have a thought? What we're really talking about is living an awake life. And whether that leads to an idea of enlightenment, or whether that's just making us more engaged in our world, or whether in fact they're the same thing, I don't know. You know? Does anybody else have any thoughts about it?
Well, it just occurs to me that if you're mindful, which is, I think, what we're meditating to become, more mindful. If you're more mindful, then you will automatically, this moment will come across you and say, oh, am I doing what I really want to be doing? Am I not just doing what I always do?
Mm-hmm.
And somehow in that moment, there's a potential for doing something else.
Nice. Nice. They sometimes say it's when the mind recognizes it's the moment, you know?
There was a speaker, Sharon Salzberg, who said that to us. She said that you meditate, your mind goes out. The moment where you catch yourself coming back, that's what it's all about. That's,
yeah.
So I was very taken with that. And yes, that's a moment of mindfulness.
And it interesting, it's mindfulness, but what is that? Have you ever actually seen the moment? right? It is interesting, isn't it? Because we call it mindfulness as though we're awake there, and it does help us become more and more awake. But when you're wandering off and all of a sudden you notice you're wandering off, right? Something happened before you notice, right? There was a jerk. Trungpa Rinpoche used to call it a jerk of awareness. Like, oh, you know. And he used to tell his students, you can think of me as your jerk of awareness. Like something brings us back, right? But it's like you don't see the event, really. You see the footsteps around the event somehow. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And she's pointing to something really quite profound. And it's interesting, because how many people actually do their meditation going, oh, I keep thinking, I wish I wasn't thinking, I wish I, you know. And it's actually knowing you're thinking is beautiful. Like that's this moment of freshness in the mind, when the mind actually sees something different and goes, oh, look at that. So it's through that massive thinking we can actually begin to see the real kind of mechanics underneath it all, or glimpse it. I don't know how much we see. Yes, ma'am.
I mean, I don't want to put down being able to function without thinking and without being mindful, because it's very helpful. You have something to do, you get it done better than if you're going back and forth, but there was the other thing that I just spoke about. So
absolutely. So I think that moment of sort of fresh thought, that moment of clarity, that different traditions call it different things, but you have this kind of like spark of awareness, if you will. You're right. You can't just keep having that. You have to actually put your clothes on, you know. But I think what it does is it keeps us fresh. Like I write, and when I start really being brilliant with my writing, I usually am not that brilliant. Like it's stuff I read back and go, oh, okay. Because I wasn't present anymore. Does that make sense? And so the more we could come back from that jerk of awareness, even occasionally, I think it changes your life. I think it adds sunlight and air to your life.
You know? Yeah, it does.
Yeah, yeah, thank you. Yes?
I guess I have two questions. The thing about the to-do list, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people who likes to prepare for things because I think it's helpful, and I feel a lot less insecure when I know that I've written every single thing that I'm going to do out before I do it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it gets thrown away, and a lot of times I have to improvise. But for me, having that stuff laid out gives me a certain sense of security. Mm-hmm. But I also, I'll give an example.
Yeah.
So I have to wake up, like today I woke up at 4:15 and I worked through all the training programs that I was going to do with my clients early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I took away from my sitting practice because I don't really want to sit at 4:15 in the morning. And so that gets in the way of my meditation practice. Luckily I knew I was coming here tonight. But then when I go, it doesn't turn out the way I expected it, right? I wrote out the whole program, and one of the clients today, I really felt like I wasn't very present with him, and I don't feel like he had a really good time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, well, maybe I shouldn't prepare my PT session with him, and I should just meditate instead, you know, wake up a little later. So that's kind of like the two ends of the spectrum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you spend all this time preparing and or do you not? I mean, I don't know. How do you handle it with your talk?
Yeah,
right?
Okay. So what I find is we need a scaffold. That's what we call it in kind of like organic coaching, right? Rather than a structure. It's more of a scaffold. And the idea of a scaffold is it's not the cathedral, right? It's what helps you build the cathedral. And even the cathedral isn't the point because it's not the spirit inside, right? So the outer things, the structure, is only there to help support what you want. Does that make sense? Or your passion. But what happens for a lot of people, it becomes the point. Does that make sense? And they lose the spirit. They lose the humanity of it. I was, and hopefully getting away, much away from, but very guilty of that when I spent time as a chef. I was really good at muscling people and a group of people to get a product out. In fact, was told I was very good at it. And didn't really care so much about the people all the time. right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It starts to squeeze down and becomes goal-oriented, and people are telling you you're good, but there's nobody enjoying the process, right? And it wasn't until I got into the Dharma and started cooking in Dharma centers when I realized you have to infuse space and the possibility of mistakes, right? And I think for people that are very list-oriented, mistakes are kind of an anathema, right? We're just adding a little of that. So I would keep the lists. I would just realize that they're just there to support what's really happening. Does that make sense?
Thank you, yeah.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your talk. Going back to kind of what you brought up with the how we think of kind of a pole star, and kind of got me thinking about how the pole star is the pole star because it doesn't move in the sky. But in Shambhala, they talk a lot about the sun and kind of the great eastern sun, and kind of made me think how the sun, it's always there, even though we can't always see it. Like right now it's night, so we can't see it, but we all know it's there. And it seems like it's not moving, but even the sun is moving around the galaxy, and we're moving around the sun, and the Earth is spinning as it's moving around the sun. So to kind of look at nowness and kind of that guiding light as something that's always there, even though we're not always seeing it, and we could, you know, detach from the Earth and just rotate around the sun ourselves and always be staring at it. But if the sun didn't, or if the Earth didn't spin as it went around the sun, it would be neglecting half of the Earth, and that side of the Earth would freeze, and the other side of the Earth would scorch. So I feel like it kind of comes down to just not a knowledge that the sun will rise tomorrow, but just like the felt sense that like the sun is there, like regardless of whether it rises tomorrow or not, the sun is still shining on something. So I guess I kind of look at it more like, even though it doesn't always, it's the kind of thing that you always want it. You always want that guiding light. You always want to be able to see it, so that way you know you're on the right path, but you can't know because you can't always see it. But you can know that you will see it again.
Well, I like to say the reason you could know it's there in your heart is because it doesn't really exist. You know? It's a technique that we use to find wakefulness and freshness in our life. Does that make sense? Right? So all the images that we use about the sun are things the sun really can't do, like shine on your head, or you know what I mean, or in your heart. But yet, when we say those things, when you have a visual image of something in meditation, the brain configures and it changes. It changes how we feel about our heart. So those techniques are used so that we actually can have the experience. Does that make sense? Of this fresh mind, this pure mind, if you will, before it gets encumbered and with a lot of doubt and stuff like that. But thank you, you're absolutely right. But if it's not the sun, if the sun is only the finger pointing to the moon, do you guys know that saying? The finger pointing to the moon is not the moon. So the Dharma, Buddhism, is just leading us to something, but it's not the thing. The thing is kind of indescribable. But what do you think the sun is?
Well, I mean, the sun is what it provides us. Like, I can't go out there and touch it, but I can see a plant that is growing because of it. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, you're right, it's undescribable, it's unknowable. I don't know how hot it is. I'm sure scientists know exactly the temperature, but they haven't touched it themselves.
What is it speaking to in your heart, though, in your psychology?
It's something that, even though I don't know what it is and I can't touch it, you look around you, and that's, I don't even want to use the word proof, but it's because it exists, we know that everything exists, kind of.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And you don't, I think, have to define it more, right? There's a question here. And not putting down any kind of more theistic religions or traditions. It's not that. Buddhist tradition and Shambhala are different. They're non-theistic. So the idea is that we don't attribute everything to a god or an external thing, but that leaves us with, well, what the hell is it then? You know, what is making me inspired and making me feel alive?
Well, I like to say that everything that I ever needed to know, I learned from my dog, who provides just, or did until she died, just an enormous amount of unconditional love that when I look at the people or places or whatever that, you know, people, living things mostly, that with that same sensibility or that same feeling, it's really kind of magical. I mean, you sort of forget what, where you even are, what you're doing. And I'm not talking about love. I'm just talking about strangers on the street or neighbors or the person who runs your local shop or whatever. And it doesn't happen all the time, and it doesn't happen even all that often. But when it does, you know, you know it right away. What I struggle with is that same sense of, or capacity for that same feeling when in the presence of someone who has caused me to suffer or caused someone I love to suffer. And I'm not sure, what is that about? Like, you would think that if we're going to be good, we would be able to do that with anyone we see. Or and it doesn't work for me.
Well, do you want it to? Yeah, there you go. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's being honest with where you are in the process. And the idea that, oh, you should love people that hurt you and that's not really how you feel, what good is that? That's just like a Band-Aid or something. It's a religion, you know?
Yeah, it's more religion.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I'm supposed to like people. So I love this. Dr. Martin Luther King said, he was talking to his congregation who, toward the end of his life, just might have been in the speech before he died in April. But he was telling that the Bible says you should love your enemy, but it doesn't say you have to like your enemy. So in other words, there are ways that we feel that are just really how we feel because of some programming on our part or some programming between the other person. But the actual energy of being alive and the salvageable nature of everyone is still there. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure I believe that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That you could actually use love as a way of communicating with these people. That's, and not like, oh, I love you, but just loving yourself so that you're not creating more damage in your body and heart. Does that make sense? Bringing love into the moment, just like the sun, that the idea of that is activating this brilliance in our body so we get rid of the tension, so we're not coming from a place of defensive, posturing. Does that make sense? Yeah, think about it, or don't think about it. And Eric here.
I was reading something about the sun.
Yeah.
That the sun nourishes the soul and spirit just like it nourishes the core of a fruit.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, that's really wonderful. Yeah.
But what I seem to see is that when this moment isn't being trusted, that it's unfolding as it is meant to unfold or perfectly. Because I think I don't like it, or I don't want it, or I desperately want it, that's when the past and the projections into the future take us out of the moment, seemingly.
Nice. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. And while the mic goes over, I just thought of something, which is, Maybe God has a plan, and maybe she has no idea what it is either. You know, like you know, maybe there is the intelligence of the universe is still discovering itself. We don't know. I think the point is to be here with this fresh mind and not caught in something. Yes.
So I was thinking about the sun as like basic goodness, mm-hmm. right? That kind of thing that you hope is always there. Right in Shambhala, like it, you would think it's always there, but you're not always capable of seeing it. And I teach first graders, and I feel like that's really helpful with that because you do see it pretty consistently, as opposed to sometimes with adults. But my question kind of matches all of these with how in Shambhala, what do they say about noticing the difference between just being in your present and being in kind of like a bad habit, like trying to fit yourself into a square mm-hmm. when you're, you know, round peg, like that yeah. difference of butting your head against the wall because yeah. you think you have to just be in a situation that maybe isn't the right one for you.
You know that joke about butting your head against the wall? Why do you do that? Oh, it feels so good when I stop. But you're asking a deeper question, and thank you. And thank you for bringing up the basic goodness, because that is ultimately what we're talking about, what you're talking about. It's not actually the sun, which will disappear at some point, right? But there's something more fundamental, possibly. And the Shambhala teachings point to that, that there is a fundamental isness to our experience that is not only valuable, but is profoundly good. You know, it's here, and it can only be accessed, I think, really here, and through total acceptance of what's here. So when you are talking about the counterposition, when you're, what was it? Tense or angry?
Well, just when you're trying to just be, but maybe you're staying in a scenario that isn't really good for you.
I see.
And
yeah.
you're trying to be like a square peg fitting in a round
yeah.
hole.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're taking just being in a different direction.
Yeah. And
how
so
do you know
this
the
is
difference?
A larger question, right? But there's, we talk in, because Shambhala comes from the tantric traditions, which come from the yogic traditions in India, like yoga. And yoga talks a lot about body, speech, mind, or body, spirit, and mind, right? And there are actually three different categories and three different ways of mental processing. So your brain might say, yes, be here now. I'm here. I'm in the present. Ah. But your heart is going, that son of a bitch. You know. And meanwhile, your body's getting tense because of your heart, right? So I like to think of it as like you've got like the parents, the you know, masculine and feminine, you know, cerebral cortexes, and then you've got the children and the hippocampus in the emotional world, and then you got the dog, you know, down here in this, you know, base brainstem, and the dog starts barking and the kids start screaming, and the parents just like drink. You know, because it's like, you know, right? The brain, or else try to figure it out, you know what I mean? Or something like that. And it's like the brain talking to the children, or like, you know, people do. You've seen people talk to their dogs in ways that are like kind of nauseating. They're like, well, Henry, you know that. It's like, it's a dog. Dogs are pure transmitters of love, as you said, right? It's just about love. It's about. So when we feel impacted in the body, we have to love that. We can't talk our way through it. Can't mentally reframe that. That's like a survival instinct, right? Freezing up. And we have to actually bring awareness, which is like water in that it's a universal solvent in terms of waking up. But being aware kind of naturally rebalances things in time. So that's what we're here. That's all we're here to do, I think, is to practice that awareness. And if we can make it loving awareness, it's even more effective. If we could bring a sense of love into that impacted body, then it kind of calms it more. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And no matter what your brain tells you about enlightenment, if your heart is still pissed off at somebody, it needs time, right? So as I was saying with you, don't let that person make more pain in your life. Take care of your own body and your own heart and bring yourself back to Wakefulness.
Thanks, Joe. Hey, visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes, weekend retreats. Again, Meditation in Everyday Life is our introductory meditation course beginning on April 6th. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, various theories of enlightenment, whatever you got, we'll take it. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. But if you are in the New York City area, come say hi. These talks are recorded at our weekly Dharma gathering, which happens every Tuesday night, except April 4th. But otherwise, every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, where you can hear these teachers and meet the other people live and in person. Later.